As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello and welcome to The Game with me, Gabriel Marcotti. I'm here with a handpicked selection of the top writers from The Times, and not just them, but Rory Smith and James Ducker as well, to find out what the hell is happening in football. And here to demonstrate their love and knowledge of the beautiful game are the aforementioned Messrs. Smith and Ducker and Clive Petty, who in the absence of Tony Evans is our boss. Later, we'll be looking at the incredible promotion battle in the Championship, where it seemed no one wanted to join the Premier League, and we'll be looking at the latest standings in the Wenger Cup. But let's kick off at the Champions. I was contacted via Twitter by one of our loyal listeners, and he pointed out, like, please don't talk about the big four, the big clubs again, blah, 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 because nothing happened in these games, and it's all very dull. And it's true, and I was going to make it a sort of a Chelsea United free zone, also because the game was terrible and nothing happened. But I think we do have to talk about the incident at the end and some of the storylines. Ducker, let's start with you. Did anything worthwhile happen in this game with the exception of Chelsea's goal and the David Luiz incident?
The short answer, Gab, is no.
Okay, good. So we can move on from there.
Yes, indeed.
Let's start with the incident now, because I don't know. Sometimes you get managers who, after the game, talk about incidents and controversy to deflect attention from something else. In this situation, frankly, you know, you're Sir Alex, you won the league, so you lost this game. Who cares? I couldn't understand why he got so wound up by this business with David Luiz, because from what I saw, Luiz may have elbowed Rafael in shielding the ball. He may not have. But the reality is the guy kicked him or certainly attempted to kick him. And whether he was smiling or guffawing or pointing a finger and laughing in Rafael's face afterwards or not, it's kind of immaterial. Your guy, who's been one of your better guys this season at right back, got himself foolishly sent off. Am I wrong here, Ducker?
Well, I think if you actually watch the interview, two things happen with Ferguson. One, he doesn't defend. He doesn't try to sort of admonish Rafael of blame. You know, he does accept that he was wrong to retaliate, and he was right to be sent off. He's obviously he's had a good moan about David Luiz, but it wasn't some, you know, outraged, furious sort of, you know, fist sort of thumping tirade which you do sometimes see with Ferguson and have in the past. But I mean it was. You know, obviously the points were obviously put to him, and I think that they were worth making. You know, Luiz did elbow or appear to elbow Rafael in the chest twice, and I think because he's got form for this, and thought actually Ray Wilkins explained this pretty well on Sky, he has got form for sort of, you know, for flailing arms and all the sort of things. I think you saw it in the build up to the Aguero incident. In the cup semi-final, you know, there was all sorts of elbows in, arms out from Luiz, and clearly that does not defend.
Well, I can accept all this, but what I don't get here, James, though, and sorry if I jump in, is you're having a go at David Luiz for grinning afterwards. correct me if I'm wrong, I believe there was a referee in that game, a guy named Howard Webb.
He also had
a linesman as well who was right there, one of those linesmen who were told is always like one of the best linesmen in the world. So why not have a go at those guys?
He did though, Gab. He had a moan at them. He said he didn't get anything from the referee all day, and he didn't think Webb had properly actually seen the incident and couldn't understand why he hadn't done. Every single person was sort of sat around watching that in the press room afterwards, was looking at it thinking, he's gone down, he's got his back to and head to Howard Webb, and he's smirking and he's smiling, he's thinking, I'm going to lie down a little bit longer here, milk it for a bit longer, see if that sort of helps my cause and getting Raphael done for. I mean, he's clearly not hurt. I just thought, you know, it wasn't a surprise because unfortunately this sort of thing happens a lot, but it was just, you know, it just wasn't great to see, really, was it?
It's, well, I don't know, I don't admit, I don't buy the whole kind of this is the worst thing that, you know, a professional can do thing. I mean, James, I'm not saying that you're saying it, but you look at the back page of some of the papers today and it's as though he's committed a major criminal offence. All he's done, Raphael's lashed out, shouldn't have lashed out. The whole thing is Raphael's fault. And the same way with the Suarez thing, you can complain about the ban all you like. What Luis Suarez should have done is not bitten Branislav Ivanovic. Rafael shouldn't have kicked David Luiz. Whether Luiz was smiling because he thought he might get him sent off, I don't know. I think he maybe was smiling because he thought it was funny that he made Rafael lash out. He'd done his job. That's football. It happens all the time.
Or maybe he also can spend most of the time walking around with his goofy grin on his face as well. If anybody's around,
I agree.
That,
it's a little bit unseemly, but I don't. It's not a big deal.
Clive, we'll move on from this unless you want to talk about this at extreme length. But I'm reminded, obviously, about 2006 and Cristiano Ronaldo and when Wayne Rooney was sent off and the wink and the way the media is going on and on and on about the wink. And I kind of thought, like, it's a bit different here. I mean, I can understand if you take a dive and somebody gets somebody sent off and then you start giggling at it, maybe. But I don't – I mean, is there a parallel?
What, with the Ronaldo wink?
Yeah.
Well, I just think it's kind of the professionalism of the sort of game now. That's what it's kind of. What I don't think we should single out Luiz for doing anything that any other professional footballer doesn't really do. You know, lots of footballers will go down, they will roll around a bit, and they'll get up and they'll dust themselves down after, you know, be running around 2 seconds later. He just got caught on camera. I mean, that's the crime here, getting caught on camera, in my opinion. You know, that's what professional footballers, he's no different from a lot of them. And I think a lot of it actually is a bit of a kind of a xenophobic element in here as well. It's always, I get the impression there wouldn't have been so much made of it if it had been an English guy who had been on the floor. I think even Sir Alex Ferguson said something like, foreigners kind of do this a lot. And I think we've got to get past that argument now, surely.
Can I ask James a question?
Yep.
Since you were there, was it Ashley Cole who went over to Luiz when he was on the floor?
It
should have been, because that was kind of his position. Do you know what I mean? That he'd be the natural contender to
be there. To do what?
Sorry. Well, so Luiz, from what we saw on the telly, Raphael kicks Luiz. Luiz goes over, and then he's grinning on the floor, and he rolls over to look at what's happening. And someone told him to stay down. And I think my guess is that would be Ashley Cole.
Oh, right. I don't know who that was.
Chelsea player, I guess, who was probably there to check on whether Luiz was all right. And then Luiz sort of rolls over with a grin on his face and he looks up to see what's happening. And someone clearly says to him, stay down. And I think that was Ashley Cole. I'm not certain, but I think it was Ashley Cole.
We blamed Ashley Cole for so many of the world's ills.
We might as well.
We can certainly dump
this one on him
as well.
But my point is linked to what Clive just said. I think there is an element of this is what foreign players do. This is cheating. It's the same with Oster asking for the card.
The red card.
This is perceived as being a foreign thing, and it's either irrelevant or slightly xenophobic. And we all need to kind of get over that element of it.
From xenophobia to Raphaphobia. I'm told that on 606, all of a sudden there's a whole spate of Chelsea fans coming out and some of them apologizing for some of the booing of Rafa. Now, I don't know if anybody's done any scientific polling on this, but Clive, do you sense a change in the way they look at Rafa? Maybe they want to keep him around instead of that other guy?
No,
neither do I.
No.
I had to ask.
I just think – I think they've kind of bought into the fact that Chelsea are actually still going and being successful. And they bought into the fact that they might have bought into the fact that, you know, booing good old FSW, as he's officially known, isn't going to work, and the team is, you know, they're in a final. They're going to more than likely claim that Champions League place. That's all they kind of want, and they might as well just get behind the team. The wasted effort of booing Rafa now is actually seen that now as a wasted effort. Let's get behind that team because they're going to fulfil the objectives. And I think perhaps, and well, maybe part of them do actually see that they do owe him some credit here. I mean, you know, how many games have Chelsea played now? This is that was their 65th game or something, and the much hated Rafa rotation policy seems to have served them pretty well. I mean, to get that squad through that many games and still be in with a chance for the, you know, of having a successful season is something to be applauded, surely.
From Rafa to somebody who's far more handsome, Wayne Rooney. Now, James, you've written about this. You've written about links with Paris Saint-Germain. There's still an elephant in the room of his contract, which, you know, will enter the final 2 years. And, you know, sometimes you see Rooney drop, sometimes you see Rooney not playing well. What's the latest? What sense are you getting?
I think it's a very difficult situation to call Gab at the moment. From all the conversations I have about it, it's a Rooney's own camp are sort of in the dark as to what's going to happen, and they're waiting for the season end and to see if that that sort of brings any greater clarity to the situation. What is indisputable is that there have been lots of sort of very blunt sort of barb references from Ferguson towards Rooney this season. You know, there's a clear, you know, there's not a breakdown as such in their relationship, but it's anything like it was. I do believe, from everything that I'm told, that if a suitable offer does come in, I believe Ferguson is open to selling him. Now, obviously, that's not straightforward because there are not that many clubs that could afford him, not necessarily that many clubs he would want to go to.
Can you quantify what you think a suitable offer might be?
Well, I mean, he's 28 in October. You know, he could argue, and United might argue, even if they actually privately think otherwise, that he's at or around his peak. Although the simple fact that they'd be open to selling would suggest that they don't believe that. Entering two years left, I mean, you know, I think if they got the money back on him, which is, you know, around about the £25 million mark, then I think that would represent very good business. Say they did make the decision to sell him, I don't think you could take his sale in isolation. You know, Paul Scholes is most likely going to retire this at the end of the season. Darren Fletcher, God bless him, you know, I think they've written that situation off. And there's a lot of uncertainty over Anderson and Nani. So there is going to need to be, if Rooney goes on top of sort of the Scholes and situation, there's going to be a need to be a major forward acquisition and a major midfield acquisition. I mean, obviously, they appear to be making sort of provisions for that. There's a lot of talk about it. I know they're looking extensively at Lewandowski. So, you know, everything would sort of suggest that they are working towards a situation whereby, you know, sort of plans are in place either to get a player in with a view to selling Rooney or having a sort of contingency plan in place in the event that Rooney does go.
The thing, just very quickly, Gab, the answer, that look on your face says it better be really quick.
Or really good.
In terms of the number of clubs who can afford Rooney or would even be tempted, right. I don't think it's even a few. Yeah. I think it's one.
Who's the one?
I think the only club that could possibly go for him on those wages and could use him is Paris Saint-Germain. Don't think there's anyone else.
I don't think Paris Saint-Germain have any use whatsoever for Wayne
Rooney. Theoretically, they could. Who else? Is Barcelona?
I think theoretically, it's actually, you know, unless you think you're going to get some kind of commercial return, City or Chelsea, assuming that they have any interest whatsoever in the guy. And that's why I think United are keeping a hard line. And I think he's going to end up re-signing for less money, personally. Yeah. I mean,
that's a very, very realistic suggestion from United's perspective, but since when do since when do players resign on the small contract?
Well, this can be a first. It's,
well, it
it's
would,
market
it would,
forces.
It would be not. It would be a novel case, to say the least. Cal.
It's market forces.
Or does he
at worst,
does he not sign a new one? Does he run it down and go to Everton when he's 29-30?
How cool would that be?
On a free.
Once a blue, always a blue. Remember. All right, enough Rooney United and so on. Let's move on to what our Spurs supporting producer calls the Wenger Cup, a.k.a. a top four finish. Right now, for those who haven't noticed, Chelsea are on 68 points, Arsenal on 67, Spurs on 65. Chelsea have that big home clash against Spurs on Wednesday night, and it's Villa away, then it's Everton at home, Arsenal, Wigan at home, Newcastle away. Spurs, Stoke away, Sunderland at home after their trip to Stamford Bridge. So I think it's quite interesting because except for Chelsea v Everton at the end of the season, you know, potentially these are all games, you know, against teams that are going to be fighting to avoid relegation. From what we've seen at the weekend, and of course all 3-1, Clive, has your opinion changed at all? How do you see this one working out?
Well, as the club's finishing the top four?
Yes.
Even being a Spurs supporter, I tend to think I'm being a bit pessimistic. I think they might possibly be in the positions that they're going to finish in now. To be fair, although, can I reserve judgment until after Wednesday night?
Because that makes it easy.
Oh yeah. Well, I didn't say that would be a bad thing. It's in at least the option being it's all in Spurs' hands. Up to that match, you know, Arsenal. They can go on, they can win all their games and still not do it. So it's in Tottenham's hands. Well, do I think they're going to get something out of Chelsea on Wednesday night? It's very hard to call. I don't know.
Roy?
Chelsea and Spurs draw on Wednesday. Chelsea will get 4 points from their other two games. I think they'll probably win both of them. They'll finish third. Arsenal beat Wigan. Spurs will win their other two games. And I think Arsenal will lose at Newcastle on the final day. So I think it'll be Chelsea third, Spurs fourth.
Increasingly, I see that as a viable scenario. I mean, as bad as Newcastle are, they could well be desperate.
It all depends, actually, not even on the game on Wednesday night. What it really depends on is what's to play for at the bottom. If Newcastle could go down, they will win at home on the final day.
Ducker.
I'm going to disappoint Clive, and I think it will finish as they currently stand. Chelsea coming third, I think, will beat Spurs on Wednesday, and I think we'll take 3 or 4 points from the games against Villa and Everton. I think Arsenal will beat Wigan and Newcastle, which is still a big call to make because they've been on a fantastic run, but there is a flakiness there. But I think they will win both, and I just think that the Spurs potentially losing on Wednesday night will kill them. I expect them to beat Stoke and Sunderland absolutely, but that won't matter if they lose to Chelsea and Arsenal win both their two games.
Wow, ballpoint. I'm increasingly leaning towards the Chelsea and Spurs scenario, but time will tell. Now let's see. Let's play the same game at the opposite end of the table.
Can I just say, Dab? Actually, Dab has, as he does every week, has prepared for us a sheet of paper with a number of salient and relevant points on it, in which he has written "run in," although he's left off the word relegation, and listed the fixtures for Wigan, Sunderland, Newcastle, and Norwich.
You're saying that I should have included Southampton as well?
No, you should have included every single team in the bottom half. Because there is a Fulham. Is it Fulham and Stoke are on 40?
Yeah.
They can still go down, and there is no reason whatsoever to believe if anyone's seen Fulham play recently, they are not getting a point from anywhere at the moment. So all of those 10 teams are still in it, very much so. Wigan will get 41.
Well, for those who I suppose I kind of got bored of writing, and I could have included all those other teams. It is kind of remarkable.
Very unprofessional.
You're right. It is unprofessional of me, and I apologize to our listeners. Wigan are on 35. They've got 3 games to play. Sunderland on 37. They've got 3 to play. Newcastle on 38 with 2 to play. Norwich on 38 with 2 to play. And then you've got Southampton on 39. And I guess
Fulham, Stoke, Villa.
Fulham, Stoke, and Villa on 40. Now, it's an absolute cluster mess, and of course on top of that Sunderland are hosting Stoke tonight, which obviously could make a very, very big difference in how things pan out, depending what the result is. If you know, a Sunderland win, I think. And if you're Stoke, you do start to worry a little bit. And equally, if you're Sunderland, you're still not safe. So this whole, like, 40 points, you're okay thing, that's all gone out the window. Rory?
Yeah. As I say, I think Wigan will win their two home games, which gives them 41, which means I think 41 has to be the basis of staying up. Looking at the fixtures,
jump in there 1 second, though. If you argue that, then basically you're arguing that Villa on 40 points. I mean, you don't think Wigan Villa on the last day of the season, I mean, will that be, if that's the kind of game where a point's enough for Villa, you don't, I mean, or do you think Villa will be safe by that point?
Because Villa have got two games left, haven't they?
And one of them is Chelsea away.
Chelsea at home.
Sorry, Chelsea at home, yeah.
Which I don't think they'll win, so I think it could well be Villa. But I also think there's a very real risk that it's Fulham, to be perfectly honest.
I think the point, I think I sort of side with Rory in that. I think I just think Wigan are going to win the two home games to get to 41, but I don't think that necessarily will mean the benchmark sort of 41 for staying up. I look at some of the teams like, you know, Norwich on 38, and I just can't see them getting to 41 points. I think sort of,
you don't think Norwich can beat West Brom
if they beat West Brom at home?
There's a funny mentality coming in here, isn't it? Those teams that haven't really been thinking about this situation for a long time, you know, they've already thought, well, it's those guys, you know, it's been about five, possibly six teams for a number of weeks now, and all of a sudden, you know, as you say, the Norwiches, the Fulhams of this world have suddenly got to go. Even Southampton have now, because everybody weeks ago said Southampton, what a great effort! It's, you know, they're safe, and all of a sudden they're now looking back over their shoulders again. And I don't know that mentality switch.
That's the hardest thing to do, is to get yourselves back up to that intensity. And that's why the other one you'd have to think about is Stoke. I don't know who Stoke have got on the final day, but Stoke lose at Sunderland tonight or yesterday, depending on when you're listening to this, then they're on 40 points. Or aren't, depending on what happened last night, and that's they will have that problem as well.
But Stoke have Southampton away on the last day of the season.
Stoke at least were already, Pulis was in that mindset that he was already thinking about their record points total. They were in that mindset of staying up, so they were actually not in a bad place after, what was it, one win last week. Actually, it kind of stopped the rot.
I think someone will go down with. I think that the 18th place team will finish with 39 points and go down in goal difference. I can just see that happening.
I hope not, because I think goal difference is a stupid way to decide who goes down, and they should have a one-game playoff, but we've been there, and that's no time to debate this. Quick predictions. Who's going down? Ducker.
Newcastle.
Ooh. Clive.
I tend to agree with James. I think Newcastle.
Ooh. Rory.
Stoke.
You're sure it's not just wishful thinking because you're a fancy Dan foreigner, no?
No, I think Stoke got Spurs at home next Sunday. If they lose at Sunderland tonight. Right, hang on. Depending on when you're listening to this. if Stoke have lost at Sunderland, they've got Spurs at home and Southampton away. They'll lose both of them and go down. If they've won, I suspect it'll be one of the others. Fulham.
Before you very much, you know, asking our opinion, come on, who do you think is going then?
You know what, I'm going to say Wigan, for the simple reason that we take it as granted that they're going to stay up, because though they've stayed up before. And I do think the Swansea game is on paper.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Gimme, by the same token, if you're Swansea, you're totally relaxed. You can take chances against Wigan. I think Arsenal away is a pain in the butt. Villa on the last day of the season, if Villa's still in it. You know, I just think we kind of, you know, we've all bought into Roberto Martinez's super powers, but I think it's... I think it does make a big difference when you've got fewer points than the opposition and a tough running.
It's brilliant, though, isn't it?
What
given
is?
That the top of the league's so boring, I mean, the
this is so much better. And it gets even better because in our debate we're going to go further down to the championship. Now, regular listeners will know the championship is not my forte. I did try to prepare for this, and I did watch those dramatic scenes on the final day of the season. Now, for those who don't know, at least at the very top, Cardiff are already Cardiff had already clinched promotion. They were traveling to Hull. Hull basically needed to, better Watford's result to be guaranteed to stay up. Watford had a home game against Leeds, which looked kind of like a gimme. Hull were in very bad shape with a bad set of results. Seesaw game, Steve Bruce, missed penalties, yada, yada, yada. Watford drama because the starting goalkeeper, Manuel Munia, injured himself during the warm-up. His backup, Jonathan Bond, then got hurt during the game, colliding with his own player. And so they went to the third goalkeeper who, let's just say, made several huge blunders in the game. They also had a man sent off. In fact, but first of all, I want to clear this up. I asked several people, ex-pros, yesterday. I said, had Watford been playing away, would they have still have brought three keepers and who would have been in goal? And to a man, most people said, no, you don't really bring three goalkeepers on the road. Does that strike anybody as kind of weird and stupid?
I think the guy, Bonham, just happened to be, I mean, he was there for the last game of season party, basically. I don't think he expected to be playing at all. It was almost like whip off your blazer and tie some and get on the pitch. That's from I may have got that wrong, but
you name a 19-man.
He was there. He's in the squad.
You take a 19-man matchday squad and your extra man can be a player in any position, and in my experience, it's normally an outfield player.
But you can bring more people and then change. If somebody gets injured during the warm-up, you can change your squad. That's what I'm saying.
I guess you can do.
He was at home, so he was at the ground. Had they been playing away...
I think there's no guarantee he would have been that now.
Right. Which seems kind of stupid to me.
Yeah, but it was a day of... I mean, and James will speak obviously about Hull, but at Watford, where I was, it was a day of ridiculous sort of coincidence and happenstance and all this stuff. Best summed up by the fact that Leeds, about 10 minutes before kickoff, realised that Zach Thompson, who was meant to be playing in midfield, wasn't registered to play, and they had to bring in Michael. They had to take Michael Brown off the train, off the warm up, and say, "Michael, you're playing now."
Wait, the Michael Brown,
the hatchet man, Michael Brown. They had to do that within 10 minutes, and if they hadn't, they could have been fined. They might have even have been docked points, and if results had gone the other way elsewhere, Leeds should have been relegated if they'd lost that game.
This is insane.
I mean, it was the whole thing, the whole day was completely ridiculous.
So there is no club secretary at Leeds right now, is there? Isn't that the club secretary's job to make sure everybody's...
I'm not sure if there's no club secretary at Leeds, but whoever is in charge of that did not cover themselves in glory.
Ducker, Hull, I was struck by this because, I mean, well, first of all, Cardiff didn't have much to play for, but Pride, and I thought they played well. I thought it was kind of dramatic when Nicky Maynard scored that penalty. But I looked at this team, and you saw Steve Bruce, and I was watching on TV on the sidelines, and it was impossible not to have a tiny shred of you sort of to want Hull to do it, right?
Oh yeah, I mean,
he looked so adorable.
It was just captivating. I mean, Rory's obviously run us through the sort of remarkable, unscriptable plot lines at Watford. I mean, it was very similar at Hull. You had, you know, he's got horrendous injuries up front. He was without something like four strikers, so he was playing his left wing back, Robbie Brady, in the hole behind the striker, you know, as a second striker. Actually had a great game as well. You had Fraser Campbell, who helped Hull get into the Premier League first time round in 2007-08 season, coming off the bench within 4 minutes of half time to put Cardiff up front and celebrate wildly, having been abused by the Hull supporters. Then you had Hull drawing level and then going in front with Paul McShane, who was one of only two surviving members from the 2008-2009 Premier League season, scoring, having been sort of shipped out on loan twice and being generally very unhappy before sort of Bruce got his head together again. And he thought, oh, brilliant, you know, this is he couldn't get much better than this. And then obviously that there was that bonkers sort of crazy ending with the all started by the Hull fans thinking that the ref had blown for the final whistle and actually he'd blown to award his own team a penalty.
That's right.
So they stormed onto the pitch, and at this point you've got Paul McShane and the other players bellowing at them to get off the pitch, and actually screaming them at the time, saying, "If you don't get off quick, we're going to cancel the match, and we're going to be docked points, and we're not going to be going up." The stadium announcer was screaming at them, just about stopped short of expletives to get off the pitch. And then, obviously, after this long wait, Nick Broswitz, you know, missed his penalty, and Cardiff go back down the other end. You know, to cue this remarkable way. But what was brilliant was I'd gone down from the press box down to the sort of the press room to watch the Watford game, the last 15 minutes of it, and I walked outside. I'm not just talking 10, 15, 20 people, Gab. There were hundreds. I mean, I'd say it was even into the thousands, sort of, you know, 1,000, 2,000 Hull fans just streaming out, going home. And I said to the couple of them, what are you doing? You know, you're not just going to stay. You know, Watford are only drawing 1-1 at that time. You know, you're going up as things stand, and there's no guarantee that Watford are going to score. And they're all like, Watford are clearly going to score, aren't they? All, I spoke to about half a dozen, like, Watford are clearly going to score. Just can't face it. We're going home. I go back into the best room. The Leeds score, and I run back outside and say, Leeds have scored. You're definitely going up. And some of them just sort of like, just didn't know what to do, and they sort of carried on walking, and they sort of raced back into the stadium. It was just absolutely sort of comical almost. I just think it's remarkable. I just think it's also remarkable that only 14 points can separate sort of the final playoff spot and the last relegated team.
Well, there's a great quote from Mick McCarthy, which I suspect Gav is going to get onto the subject in a second, that if you basically in the Championship you take one off the top in Cardiff and one off the bottom in Bristol City, they're all as bad as each other. And I think that's absolutely true. There is no difference, really, in terms of football ability between.
Can
like
you
Barnsley.
Say that in Mick McCarthy's accent?
Oh, we're all as bad as each other. Does that do? That's quite sexual. I didn't mean it to be. I don't find Mick McCarthy a sexual being. Just to make that clear. Right. But in terms of that's the kind of drama, and from what we've seen, the way that it went, I'd expect like aliens to land in the playoff final or something like that.
we'll get to the playoffs in a minute. I just want to have a word on Cardiff, because you know, sometimes you get promoted early, you win your championship, and you get a little bit overshadowed. Obviously, there's been a lot's been said about the ownership and the changing colors and all that business. Clive, what's your take on this club?
In what way? They're kind of worthy champions. I think, you know, they've set up what they wanted to achieve. Not sure how well they're going to do next season. I mean, the thing about they're going to have to show as much canny insight as Swansea did. I mean, trying to lure top people to Wales. I mean, I'm not sure what the deal with Bellamy. Well,
they're going to prison. They're going. There's nice bits in Wales too.
But it's like. I still think probably say if you're a player and perhaps you've got a choice of playing for, I don't know,
Hull,
Fulham, or something like that. If the attraction is London,
yeah.
And you're not going to Chelsea, Arsenal, whatever it is, but your next competitors, I suppose, at that level for London, they say like. Fulham, if you're kind of, and yeah, perhaps you might choose that.
When it comes to soft foreigners, I will agree they all want to be in London, which gives clubs like Fulham and QPR.
Soft foreigners, nobody finds anybody else, do they?
But there are. I mean,
Cardiff need players.
I want to ask you about Hull, Ducker, because on TV it looked pretty bad, but then you told me all these guys are injured, and plus, you know, it was nervy and they're coming off a bad stretch, and I haven't seen anything else of them. Where are they in relation to, say, Reading and Southampton when they came out?
I think it is remarkable that Bruce has got them up. I sort of know what Rory's saying about sort of very similar sort of standards across a large stretch of teams, but I you know, in terms of you actually look at the sort of, you know, spare statistics in that squad, and I do fear for them. And even if they have a tremendous sort of summer in the transfer market and get a lot of players in, I think that the sort of leap that they have to make with that squad is so huge that that I just can't. I know Hull fans don't want to see this, hear this, and I really, obviously, I think it's fantastic. I want them to bask in the glow, but I just cannot see a way that they're going to stay up.
Of course, there are playoffs now to come, prolonging the excitement, and it's Watford against Leicester and Brighton against Crystal Palace. Now, you guys all seem to be pretty down on Hull and Cardiff and their chances to stay up, and I look at the teams in the playoff and. You know, Watford obviously have the potential resources of the other clubs in the Pozzo Empire. Brighton have a wealthy owner and maybe play slightly more of a continental fancy Dan style. Palace, of course, are managed by a genuine warrior of the light in Ian Holloway. And Leicester have a lot of money and some very good players. Is it fair to say that the team that wins the playoffs might have a bigger chance of staying up than Hull or Cardiff?
I think Cardiff have got. I mean, I agree with James on Hull. I think Cardiff have got a chance, but they will. All those teams will need to sign players. I would have thought that Watford, because of the Pozzo link, would probably be okay. Leicester, if the owners and the owners have got money, if they put that money into the club, they'd probably be all right. Although Leicester are rubbish, and I say that as someone whose dad supports Leicester. And I think, funnily enough, I think Brighton are probably, in terms of the side that exists now, they're probably the best equipped to cope straight away in the Premier League because they have a defined style and they have players that could fit into a more technical sort of atmosphere. So I think Brighton would probably be okay. It may well be the case that the team that wins the playoffs is the best placed going forward.
Now, I'll leave you with this fun Chris fact from our producer, Chris Skinner. It says, now that Cardiff have gone up, half of the 92 league clubs have spent a season in the Premier League. And if Brighton make it, now that will mean that more clubs will have been there than haven't. Isn't that great? All right, enough irrelevant facts. Let's move on to some quick hits. Clive, I'm assuming you've heard the joke that next year there will be three Welsh teams in the Premier League, Cardiff, Swansea, and Gareth Bale. To be fair, Spurs didn't do too much to change that impression against Southampton, did they?
No, they weren't great, but, you know, if we're always led to believe that the sign of a good team is one that doesn't play well but takes the 3 points. And let's be honest, one-man team... It's a bit unfair. I mean, you know, Messi, Barcelona, one-man team. Robin van Persie, you know, well, Robin van Persie at Arsenal, took him out of them, and look what happened. Robin van Persie at Manchester United, is that a one-man team?
Well, he left Arsenal, and then Arsenal are going to get more points this season than he got last season, so maybe it wasn't a one-man team.
I thought you didn't like the statistic about more points than last season. I thought that didn't carry any weight. Look, I mean, if anything, they have been a bit reliant on it, but it's because it shows up the policy that they should have bought some strikers in January. The strikers Defoe and Adebayor haven't been able to weigh in and back up Bale. So if it had been shared around a bit more, there would have been less spotlight.
I'm just joshing. I actually think that they're just simply really, really tired right now and look kind of spent. And also, it's not really one man team, it's maybe one and a half man team.
Because Lennon and
Hugo
Lloris,
I think, has come up very big.
I could pick out quite a few people that have had good seasons.
Christian Benteke didn't score at the weekend, but Gabby Agbonlahor did as Villa get 3 points at Norwich, which presumably will keep them up. Maybe. Ducker, this guy's just 22 and it's 18 league goals this season. What happens next, and how much will he cost? And do you like him more than the other young Belgian striking wunderkind in the Premier League?
If Villa go down, whether Benteke would want to stay or Villa would want to keep him, it doesn't matter. He will be sold because their wage bill is huge. They're trying to get it down. If he goes, he will. If they go down, he will definitely be sold. But I don't think they will. I reckon that would cost 50. Cost them 15. Some club 15 to 20 million. If they go down, he will go. If they stay up, I think he'll stay.
Newcastle come back from West Ham with a point, but Alan Pardew gets rather chippy these days. He banned a reporter at Broadsheet newspaper for alleging there were splits in the squad between the French players and the gutsy, committed, non-cheese-eating surrender monkeys. God, I love the fact they made that reference twice in the same show. Roy, what do you make of this? And have you ever been banned by a football club?
I don't think I have. I've been the victim of sort of paper bans whilst working at the newspapers. I've not been allowed to go to press conferences because the paper itself is banned.
So paper, the newspapers have the banned newspapers, you?
No, not the newspapers. The clubs have banned the newspaper rather than
not
me.
Not you personally.
Not me personally. I don't think so. I've had a few nasty phone calls. I always think it's a sign of a manager who is getting a bit paranoid and a bit upset, and it's a sign of weakness rather than strength once you start throwing the media out. Interestingly, on the radio, I think, I was listening the other day, and someone texted in and said that Luke Edwards, the reporter who'd been banned, should have been banned because he wasn't helping the manager do his job, and that if the reporters aren't helping the manager to do his job, then the manager shouldn't help them do theirs. To the people who think like that, of which there are many, why do you think newspapers exist? Football reporters go to football matches to get information to the fans. If you're happy to swallow the Pravda-style reporting that the clubs are encouraging, then that's fine. But it suggests that you don't have a very inquisitive mind or a particularly high intellect. Newspapers are there to tell you what is happening at the club that you support. That is why we are all employed. And it really irritates me when people don't realise that.
For the second week running, Theo Walcott scores inside the first 2 minutes as Arsenal win at QPR. 1-0 in a pretty dreadful match. Now, our boss, Tony Evans, says that Wenger has become more conservative in his old age, whereas when he was younger, he was more of a revolutionary, like the young Tony Evans. You're making a face, Clive. I do not make a face because he is our boss after all. But what does he mean?
He's your boss.
He's your boss too, isn't he?
He's not my boss. No.
Oh, really?
He'd like to think so, but he's not my. Well, I don't. I'm not beholden my position to Tony
he's
Evans.
He's harder than you, though, right?
He says so. He's a lot of talk about Evans.
Come on. Yeah.
All right. I hope for your sake he's not listening.
I'm going to offer him outside when he comes back next tomorrow. What does he mean? I don't want to put words into Tony's mouth, but I guess that there was a time where I suppose Arsenal and Arsene Wenger would actually spend most of their time talking about challenging and going for trophies, and now all that comes out from Arsene Wenger is talk about balance sheets and how well the youngsters are doing, and you know, maybe with their new Emirates deals and their new kit deal that's coming in and advanced TV money, they might actually stop thinking about the balance sheets and put it actually into some proper marquee signings.
Well, or maybe what they should do, of course, with all this extra revenue coming in, is provide more value to the shareholders and higher dividends, which would be the responsible thing to do. Wigan come back from 2 goals down at West Brom to win 3-2. Sean Maloney steals the show. Tucker, I remember Maloney as a kid at Celtic. I'm wondering, why did it take so long for this guy to have a breakout season, or even just a season in which he plays almost every game? It's amazing. He's 30 years old now, but he can really play, can he?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned him, Gab. He's one that's just gone under the radar for so long. Whenever I've seen him play for Wigan, I've been really, 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 really impressed with him. He's really very gifted, very comfortable on the ball, great vision, you know, comes up with some important goals as well. And, yeah, I mean, take Maloney and sort of McCarthy out of that team and, you know, he makes a big, big, big difference to them. And I think as well, he's just great. He's shown sort of great sort of flexibility, sort of you see him drifting across all, you know, or you know, both sides are very comfortable. He's really sort of bought into the way Martinez plays, and he's almost, like you say, you know, he's 29, 30. He's been given this sort of, you know, late lease of life, and he's relishing it, and he'll be integral to their hopes of staying up over the next few games.
Well, I'm glad you got the obligatory James McCarthy reference in there because, of course, we're all very big fans. It wasn't much of a Liverpool derby, but at least there was a talking point, Sylvain Distan's disallowed goal. But, frankly, it just all seems so moot at this point. So I'm not going to ask you about that. Rory, did this game kind of reflect these two clubs? And who are you more bullish on for next season, given that you're so impartial here?
I am impartial because I've got a lot of time for Everton. I think that they're an admirable side. But I do worry what happens to Everton if Moyes goes. The mood music seems to have changed a little bit now, and it looks more likely that he'll stay than he'll go. But there is a possibility, I think, that if a decent job came up, that he would leave. That would mean inevitable transition for Everton next season to someone, perhaps like Roberto Martinez, taking over. Liverpool... It's impossible to say. If you'd have asked me last week, I'd have said, yeah, great signs going forward, that even if Suarez did go this summer, that they might be all right. But then they produce a display like that, and you sort of think, well, actually, no. I think what I would say is that next season's Merseyside derbies will not be any more significant in the grander scheme of things. And Gab, one for you. There's been new champions this week in Italy, in Turkey, and in Holland. But they look an awful lot like the old champions, don't they?
Well, yes, that's because they are the old champions. Of course, all these teams repeated last season. I think they're all in slightly different situations. I think Galatasaray really took advantage of a year in which they got that mid-season spending on Drogba and Snyder, and Fatih Terim kind of really pushed the side with what was left. But I think they're going to need some serious rebuilding next season. Juventus, I think, are stronger this year. I think Serie A was strong. I think the team is stronger. Very excited for what Paul Pogba can bring, and Fernando Llorente as well, of course. As for Haaland, I think they're kind of doing it on fumes, and I think they're at the stage where now the team will be broken up, or at least somebody out of Eriksen, maybe Victor Fischer, will be moving on. But again, Haaland, to me, is also the underachievement, the complete and total utter underachievement of PSV Eindhoven. That's all for now. What a show. I've enjoyed every single moment of it, and I hope you have too. You can email us, as so many of you do every week. It's gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk. We're going to be back next week. In the meantime, of course, you can go to thetimes.co.uk. You can find our web chats. You can read our blogs, our columns. And then, of course, you can hunt us down on Twitter and argue with us. Clive, you're what, C3PO on Twitter, something like that?
CP01.
CP01, close enough. And of course, you are Rory Smith.
Rory Smith Times, yeah.
Rory Smith Times. And I think Ducker, you are Ducker the Times, right?
Yes, indeed.
There you go. All slightly different, all slightly the same. I'm, of course, just plain and simple, Marcotti, MARCOTTI, the way God intended.
You're famous, though, Gav.
That is true.
No one has a clue who I am.
I am far more famous than the rest of you. Till next time, bye bye.
Listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.